All right.
Okay. And we'll just start off with the questionnaire I emailed you, sir.
Okay.
And the first one was sort of a personal question. Since I started off in VA and then went to VS, I was just wondering how your switch went, and were there a lot of people that were switching from other communities to go attack?
Well, there were, I think, about 15. What happened was the because of the Vietnam War coming along, the Navy decided to turn the Intrepid, USS Intrepid, into a CVA instead of a CVS. And as a result, we had one too many VS air groups, so we had the oldest aircraft. We had the S-2 Deltas at the time, so they decommissioned us, even though the Intrepid wasn't our ship. I was aboard the Randolph, actually. So they decommissioned our air group, and for the junior officers, pretty much we got a pretty good deal doing whatever we wanted to is within reason. And there's about, I think, 15 of us in the air group that went from VS and HS to VA.
I see. And did you have a choice in VA or VF?
Yeah, I could have stayed in VS if I'd wanted to. It just seemed, I guess I was a young guy and eager to get in the mainstream of the war, I suppose. And this was back in 1966, when I made the transition.
I see.
It didn't look like VS was going to be doing much for a while, and VA was, so.
Sure. And how about fighters? Could you have gone like F-4s or something like that?
No, that wasn't given to us as an option. It was just A-4s or stay in VS, one of the two.
I see. And the next question I had was, I was looking at your training record, and it seemed like the rag and everything was either fairly condensed, or you all just didn't spend a lot of time on tactics and stuff like that. It just got you trained, CQ'd, and off to a squadron.
Well, we stayed the normal length of time in the rag, although, most guys who come in there are already jet, have some jet experience. We spent about 2 months in a transition squadron. Actually, it was either VA-45 or VA-43. VA-43 was the instrument squadron, instrument training squadron at Oceana, and VA-45 is the instrument training squadron at Cecil Field. And I chose or requested VA-43 because my wife was just about ready to deliver our first child. And so I made the transition from VS to VA at in an F-9. They were flying F-9s at that time at VA-43 at Oceana. And that took a couple of months. And then once we got through with that, then we went through the regular rag period. It took the regular length of time, I think. I think we were pretty well trained. We never did have any some of the things that the jet guys did in going through the train command, like we never had air-to-air gunnery, for example, which would have maybe been helpful on one occasion in Vietnam. But other than that, I think most of us were as skilled flying the A-4 as the jet guys were.
Yes, sir.
At least we thought we were.
Yes, sir. Did you know Captain Mike Eddy?
No, I saw that name. I don't know him, just off the top of my head. He didn't know me, did he?
No, actually, he was the XO at Naval Air Station Whidbey Island when I was flying A-6s there. And I just read his bio when he was retiring, and he flew A-4s in Vietnam, so I didn't know if you two knew each other.
No, I didn't know him.
I see. And so your particular air wing, what kind of squadrons and type of aircraft did that comprise of?
We had two A-4 Charlie squadrons and one A-4 Bravo squadron, which was VSF-1. They were a kind of a... They And these squadrons had never been together on a ship, oddly enough. They were from different air groups. But some, I'm not sure of the rationale for putting us all together. But VA-15 and VA-34, which is what I was in, were the two A-4 Charlie squadrons. Then VSF-1 was an A-4 Bravo squadron, which was very close to the A-4 Charlie, same engine. Just not quite the same electronics, but pretty much the same aircraft. I think they had one less. No, that's wrong. And then there was a SPAD squadron, an A1 squadron on board. And then there was a F8 debt and a RF8 debt, which supplied our fighter protection and our reconnaissance work, and a VAW debt. E1's debt aboard.
Yes, sir. And so as you started your deployment, obviously you knew where you were going. And what was the morale like on the ship amongst the pilots and the captain of the ship and the enlisted folks?
I think everybody had very high morale, as I recall. We were looking. You know, with some trepidation, I guess, but we were looking forward to it in some ways, morale was very high.
I see. And then you got shot down towards the almost the end of deployment. Had the morale changed over the course of the deployment?
No, it was still high. We were really looking forward to getting home. I mean, we were getting tired of being out there, but no, the morale was still high. We'd had, you know, I guess I was the fifth guy shot down who wasn't recovered aboard ship. We had one or two others that had to eject and were picked up. But three of us were POWs and two were MIAs and eventually became KIAs.
I see. And any training accidents other than the five that you all lost?
No training accidents at all. It was I don't know why. I mean, one thing, we didn't fly at night. We were strictly a day squadron. We tried one little experiment at night, and it went so bad. Although we didn't have any crashes, but we just didn't. They eventually left the night flying up to the A-6s, I think.
I see. And so your entire air wing did not fly at night? And did you keep night currency, or were you just a day carrier?
We just flew into daytime. On the way over there, we flew some nights. In the Med, we went through the Suez Canal, and in the Med, we flew some night flights. But we basically lost our night currency while we were there. We didn't fly any. After a one or two week trial period, I think, they decided it was just too dangerous. You know, we were dropping flares and flying under the flares, and it just, we didn't lose any aircraft, but some of the other ships lost A4s trying that stuff, and so they finally decided that was just too risky.
Yes, sir.
So we became strictly a day carrier.
Nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, I agree.
And so the five folks that you all lost, including yourself, were they all flying A4s or other equipment also?
They were all flying A4s. Yeah.
I see. And in one of your responses to the earlier questionnaire, you'd mentioned about not having the big picture. Was that pretty much across the ship? And I remember in my squadron, before heading out for some campaign or to a Middle Eastern country, usually the intel officers will put together a little intel brief that covers the political scenario and geopolitical and all that stuff. Was that something that was practiced back then also?
No, I think that's probably started as a result of Vietnam. We had a couple of briefs from one of our squadron officers who was a political science major. But to be honest, I had never heard of Dien Bien Phu until I was shot down, or I didn't even know that the French had occupied Southeast Asia until I was shot down. I knew very little about it, to be honest with you. Yes. I didn't know why it was divided. I didn't know why there was a South and a North Vietnam. I guess perhaps that had been explained by this political science guy, this lieutenant commander, who also got shot down, by the way. But in some of our, I mean, these were 1 or 2 hour briefs on the situation in South Vietnam, but I don't think he knew much about it either, to be honest with you.
Yes, sir. And then I know you'd mentioned road recce and alpha strike type of stuff. What kind of targets were you mostly assigned? And I figured from something I'd read, you were fairly low when you were shot down. So was it mostly low ingress to a low egress?
No, we were never low ingress or egress or egress. That was the lowest I'd ever been there. We basically started off, once we took off, we were at 100% pretty much till we dropped our bombs. Then we could throttle back a little bit, but the A4 Charlie was so underpowered that the only way we could have any chance at all was to come in as high as we possibly could. So we'd be at 100% from the time we took off. Well, after we rendezvoused, we'd rendezvous, you know, we'd make a circle around the ship. And once we got rendezvoused and headed off towards the beach, we were at 100%, and we just got as high as we could. Usually we'd ingress maybe at somewhere between 25 and 30,000 feet. And then we would just turn, if we were going on an alpha strike, road recces were a little different. But if we're going on an alpha strike, we would get absolutely as high as we could, and then we would start downhill and keep our airspeed up. We were in a constant. Once we got feet dry, we were in a constant jink. All the time, we were in a turn. Never, I don't think we ever flew straight and level actually over land. And we just turned in order to keep our airspeed up. We just turned altitude into airspeed, and hopefully we got to the target with enough altitude and airspeed to still be safe. But we had a minimum altitude over this was a shipboard rule, I mean a CAG rule, not to go under 3,000 feet at the bottom of a dive bombing. So we tried to roll in around 12,000 feet and 45 degree angle dive and pickle our bombs around 5,000 feet and then pull out always above 3,000 feet. That was just our policy. Never went in low or came out low. The only time we ever got low is cases like this is the second time it happened to me. There were just so many SAMs or MiGs or something that were causing us to stay in a jink so long we just lost all of our airspeed and altitude both. And that's what happened to me. I lost the day I was shot down. I learned later. I knew I saw a lot of them, but there were over 70 SAMs shot at our formations that day. The whole formation, the whole alpha strike. And so all of us were just in a constant, SAM break. And SAM breaks, you know, we used a lot of energy, so we just lost a lot of airspeed and a lot of altitude. And the time I got shot down, that's why I was so low. I was well under what was advertised as the SA-2 envelope, but nevertheless, I got hit by an SA-2. And we had heard some rumors that the SA-2 could be optically guided. So that may have been how they were doing it. I think I was below the radar envelope for the SA-2. It's supposed to be 1,500 feet, and I was down about 1,200.
Now, as you were jinking, and with as many missiles that they'd fired, was there chances for midair?
Not really. We had a couple hundred feet separation between all the aircraft, and so, you know, I was a wingman. I was number two guy, and so the section's pretty well operated, not independently, but the number four guy, you know, he just made sure he stayed with the number three guy, and I was always with the number one guy. And since we kept 100 feet between, or about 200 feet between all of us, we just never had that big a problem. Now, Alval strikes, you had to be careful. You know, the day I was shot down, first time this had ever happened, but we had actually two ships went together, put the aircraft together, and we had some like 64 aircraft on that Alpha strike. And they were just aircraft all over the sky, literally. And but I, you know, we never really had any close calls of midairs. You know, they were kind of all going the same way, so we just back and so we keep a lookout. We didn't have any real problem there.
I see. And when you were shot down, were you on an Alpha strike that day?
Yes, I was. We're attacking a barge construction yard in the outskirts of Hanoi, and also a couple of firsts on this thing. I never carried CBUs, and I had CBUs this day. I was a flak suppressor. I'd never been a flak suppressor. So just because we had two ships together, you know, they had things different than they'd ever been before. So anyway, they just, I guess because there's so many aircraft in the air, the Vietnamese decided to just fire a lot of SAMs, and they did. And I wasn't a flak suppressor, I was a SAM suppressor, which I'd never been. Our SAM suppressors usually carried Shrikes, which was the predecessor for HARM, but we didn't have Shrikes in our squadron, so we just carried CBUs.
So essentially, you would have to see where the missile was coming from and then take out that sight?
That's right, yeah. We had pretty, you asked a question about our intelligence, how current it was. It was usually very current. You know, we had our own intelligence, our own photo reconnaissance aircraft, and usually at most the intelligence was we had gotten the previous afternoon if we're going on a morning Alpha strike. And sometimes we'd go on an afternoon Alpha strike and have a recce aircraft that morning, a reconnaissance aircraft that morning, bring back pictures. So we had very, very current intelligence on the operational SAM sites. They moved them around a lot, so it had to be very current. And we were assigned, I think, three SAM sites. So we had a primary, a secondary, and a tertiary SAM site. And we were supposed to basically, this was our division, our four aircraft, and we were supposed to check out the first one, if it wasn't firing, to go to the second one. If it wasn't firing, go to the third one. And we made it, the first two were not firing, and we were, I think, on our way to the third one when I got hit.
I see. And as far as the planning goes for an Alpha strike, a road recce, were the JOs involved in strike planning, or was it just plans that were handed out during the strike brief?
These were, you know, that's an interesting question. I'm not sure exactly who did the flight planning, other than the flight lead. You know, usually the flight lead was either the skipper of the squadron, the XO, or one of the department heads. they were only those guys were cleared for Alpha strikes. The JOs really didn't get involved at all in the planning. Sometimes we go over the JOs for road wreckage. We go over to the intelligence spaces and get briefed on what was what we would expect to see on the particular road wrecky route that we were assigned. But basically, in the road wreckage, there was very little flight planning. We knew the intelligence officer got what red road wrecky route we were assigned to. I'm not sure how high that went to come. I know some of the Alpha strikes actually came down to the White House, I think, or at least the Pentagon. But the planning themselves, I think, was done by the flight lead, whoever that was. That was either CAG or one of the squadron commanders normally on an Alpha strike.
I see. Because I don't know if you've been exposed to how we're doing planning these days, but it's almost a cookie-cutter approach now. It got a big matrix built, and the strike lead goes to the matrix, figures out what kind of a strike it will be, and then dishes the responsibilities to the JOs who do all the ammunition planning. And I don't know if you had this publication called JMIM back then?
I think we did, but the JOs had nothing to do with it. JOs basically were told during our, the flight brief in the ready room what our ordnance would be and what our target was. We didn't even know that before we got there. And we would get together and the flight leader would talk a few minutes about, how we're going in and it almost became routine, even Alpha strikes. We just it became, I guess, we didn't really worry about it. At least the JOs didn't. We had our lieutenant commanders who were in the division lead, so they had to worry about that stuff. So JOs, all they had to worry about was hanging on, basically.
I see. Yeah. I'm assuming that the strike lead had the liberty to choose what type of ordnance he was going to carry and which section was going to have what, depending on the target that they were going for?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think that may have come from higher up. I think that at least might have been at the task group level. But I just don't know that. I don't ever remember any of our squadron people ever making that kind of decision, even in CAG. I'm sure CAG probably had a input to it, but I think it came down from the Admiral's staff, what ordnance we're going to use. But I'd be honest with you, I just don't know that, where that came from.
Yes, sir. And like you said, the Air Force was underpowered, and with a heavy loadout, you didn't have a lot of G available, not a lot of energy. Did you ever, when you were under a situation where you were being shot at, did you ever jettison your ordnance load or your tanks to get more maneuverability?
Only once. I jettisoned my tanks one time when I was being shot at by MiG, and I'd lost all my airspeed, and again, that was just south of Hanoi one day but we had MiGs behind us, and both of us had lost all of our airspeed, so I jettisoned my tanks that day.
I see. Now, did you encounter MiGs quite often?
No, not too often. I guess three or four occasions we had MiGs that were either trying to get at us or they were in the vicinity. We had two occasions where we actually mixed it up with MiGs. And the F-8s, they were up about 5,000 feet above us, couldn't see them, and they took a lot of ribbing for that. We had FA protection, but the MiGs somehow got in among all the bombers, and didn't shoot any down, thankfully. But we had, I think, 100 rounds of 20-millimeter ammunition, and so several of us got a shot at them, but that's what I was mentioning a while ago. It might have, on that one occasion, it might have made, if I'd had some air-to-air training, it might have been better, but that's the only thing I really ever lacked.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And then on a road recce mission, how would you positively identify that the truck or barge was hostile?
Well, if they were moving, they were hostile. We did. There was no differentiation. We just the assumption was made if it could carry stuff, it was hostile. We all barges and all trucks, in fact, all vehicles were fair game.
I see. And then with the ordnance that you carried, how accurate was this? Because I remember firing some Zuni rockets in A6 days, and those things were fairly erratic.
Yeah, they were. They weren't real accurate. We had no. We actually did have in the squadron a few bullpups, I think they were called, but we never fired any that I'm aware of or that I can recall. Because they were so expensive, we had Zunis and the rocket pods, whatever the other kind of rockets. I've forgotten the name of them, but they were used on road wreckers, and also we used if we were expecting a truck park or something, and that's usually what we were sent after, were truck parks, trying to find where they were parking or during the day. They didn't move during the day, so they were parked down there somewhere. And the intelligence people had some suspicious sights, so they would for that we usually carried bombs. So we usually 4 250-pound bombs each aircraft, and once in a while, let's say some of the aircraft would have Zunis, but usually bombs.
I see. And would you actually find trucks at a truck park like the intelligence would tell you, or a lot of times you'd find just an empty parking lot?
Well, you didn't know really, because you couldn't see it. They were all in the jungle, so you ended up just bombing the spot that you were told was a truck park a lot of times, and once in a while you get a secondary explosion, and so you, I guess we made the assumption there must have been trucks there, but more often than not, we're just bombing trees.
Yes, sir. And how long would a typical mission be? Would it involve lots of tanking?
No, very rarely did we tank. A typical mission was an hour and a half, and once in a while, if we wanted to carry a heavy load, we'd take off our tanks, and we would carry no tanks and bombs on the middle rack also. The A4C has three bomb racks. Usually we carry a tank on the center rack. But then we could carry, you know, up to about 2,000 pounds worth of bombs. And then we could get off and on in 45 minutes. We would, from takeoff to landing was around 45 minutes. That was rare. Usually it was an hour and a half turnaround cycle.
I see. How about for an alpha strike?
Alpha strike was usually an hour and a half to hour and 45 minutes. And once in a while, after we got back, some people had a tank. There was always a tanker available. But it was rare. I think I tanked once the whole time I was there.
I see. And so what was your first combat mission like?
Well, it was a little tense. I don't remember a whole lot about it other than that it was up in the area just north of the Thanwa Bridge, if you know where that is. And we were, our target was a highway bridge, and I remember we got quite a few tracers around the cockpit, which I'd never seen. So it was tense. I was scared, and I think everyone was. But Well, one of our squadrons had already been over there once, so they had some combat experience. Our squadron had never. This was their first trip to Vietnam. So I think all of us were a little more tense than the other guys, at least the other guys who had been there before.
And then as you flew more missions, did it become almost second nature that, hey, you were going into Indian country?
Well, for road wreckage, yeah, I did. I think, much rather fly a road wrecky flight for my health than I would a night carrier landing.
Yeah,
but the Alpha strikes never did get routine. They were always, we always were had SAMs fired at us. We always were at danger of MiGs. And so it was always a very tense mission for Alpha strikes. Anywhere in the Hanoi, Haiphong area, you knew you were going to get a lot of opposition, and not only the SAMs and the MiGs, but the anti-aircraft fire was intense up there too. And anytime we started towards Hanoi, you could just absolutely depend on these 85 millimeter anti-aircraft fire, you know, will be firing at you, and anywhere in that area, you know, 50 to 100 miles from, if you're heading towards Hanoi, then you'd start getting any aircraft fire well out, maybe 100 miles away. If you were not heading towards Hanoi, maybe heading, it was clear you're going somewhere south of them, then they didn't seem to care as much. But if you're heading towards Hanoi, we got to always get missiles, always get a lot of anti-aircraft fire, and once in a while, MiGs.
I see. Now, the fact that you were with an Alpha strike and lots of airplanes in the sky maybe brought that sort of response, or even if you were on a road recce close to Hanoi or Haiphong, you'd get the same treatment.
Well, we really didn't do road recces up near Hanoi or Haiphong. We always went in there with at least one, probably two divisions. We never, I don't ever remember going in there with just one division or less. So we didn't do road recces around Haiphong and Hanoi. As I recall, our division did attack, I think, a barracks one day up in the Haiphong area, but, you know, it was just 15 miles inland or something like that, so we just flew in there and hit the barracks and then left very quickly. So, but we did road wreckers usually were out in the jungles, you know, trying or on looking at the waterways, making sure we would see if we could find any barges heading south or north. We didn't care, right, as I recall.
I see. And was any of this on the Ho Chi Minh Trail?
Well, I guess this was the northern, some of it was the northern end of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. We never actually got into Laos or Cambodia or South Vietnam. Our squadron didn't. I'm not sure exactly how you'd find the Ho Chi Minh Trail, but we were primarily, kind of in the middle of the country, and I don't guess there is a well-defined trail there. They've got all kind of roads, and then they eventually, the Ho Chi Minh Trail is kind of like, I don't know if there is any defined Ho Chi Minh Trail. It's just the western part of Vietnam was all jungle, and that's where they infiltrated their supplies down through. I don't know, and we were given, you know, coordinates where they thought truck parks were, and I guess this was part of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. I just never thought of that, I guess.
I see. And then I know you've mentioned some stuff, some details about your combat mission where you were shot down. You were Dash 2 going in as SAM suppression. About 70 SAMs fired What else do you remember? Did you actually drop your ordnance on the third site?
No, I didn't. We never did get to never did drop my ordnance. I jettisoned it once I got hit, but I didn't drop it.
Now, did you see the SAM that actually hit you?
No, I never did see that either. I just, I knew, well, of course, I'd had a SAM warning for the last 15 minutes, I guess. So, I mean, we're constantly under a SAM warning, and we were constantly in a SAM break. So, we had seen several SAMs go by, but this one I didn't see. It was, I just, all of a sudden, I felt an explosion behind me. I mean, I could tell it was behind me, and out of the corner of my eye, I saw my RPM gauge go to zero. It looked like, you know, in retrospect, after thinking about it, it looked like to me the engine seized because it didn't wind down. It just went to zero within about 3 seconds, and well, maybe 5 seconds. Of course, I lost power immediately. So as soon as I got my rad out, ram air turbine out, emergency generator out.
Yeah, the A6 used to have that. We'd pull, and this little thing would pop up in the air, give us essential power.
Yeah, that's what we had in the A4. We called it a RAT, which ram air turbine, I guess, was what it stood for. But once I got that out, all my warning lights were on. Once I got this little power back, all my warning lights were on. My fire warning lights were on. My hydraulic warning lights were on. I looked out. My wings were spewing fuel. I mean, they were both ruptured. And I was low and slow. However, I did take, you know, as much time as I could. I tried one relight. And my lead, when I was got my power back on, he was screaming at me to get out. And so after, I don't know, maybe I didn't spend long enough in the aircraft to get a relight. It takes about 40 seconds for an A4 to relight under optimum circumstances. Anyway, I was getting low. I think I ejected in the neighborhood of 600-700 feet, and very mild ejection. I was going, you know, 140 knots probably, so at that time. I had to control the aircraft. I mean, I wasn't rolling or anything. The aircraft was controllable once I got my, you know, I didn't need the rat out for that, but I went to manual flight controls too because I lost hydraulics, and so I was straight and level pretty much, except I was heading down pretty fast, and then I ejected. I just it was very mild. The A4 has a rocket seat in it, and it was very no problem at all. I didn't stay in the air long. I was I probably stayed in the air 10 seconds after the chute opened, and then I hit the ground. The aircraft landed about 100 yards from me, and it blew up, of course. I basically landed in a. This was November, and the harvest had already been the rice harvest. So I landed in a dry rice field. In between, there's a village on every corner, basically, or a hamlet on every corner. Hamlet's a little smaller than a village. And the only person I saw was there was a kid, looked like maybe 10 to 12 years old, maybe 30, 40 feet from me, yelling at me with his hands over his head, I guess, like saying to give up or put your hands up or something like that. Here, I made one big mistake here. I tried to get away instead of just sitting down and calling my lead and telling him I was okay, because although he saw me land and he saw me running, but I ran into a little patch of woods in the area and hid in a little hole there. And for a while, and it took him about 15 minutes to flush me out. So.
Now, were you hurt at all in the ejection or from your jet blowing up 100 yards from you?
No. I hit the ground pretty hard, just normally, but I wasn't hurt in any way at that point.
So, now, when you hid, did the boy or did some of the villagers actually see you and direct the capture?
The boy did, I assume, because he was the only one I saw. And so it wasn't long until I heard people yelling and screaming and coming in the woods where I'd run. And these woods were not part of the jungle. They were just woods associated with a hamlet. All the hamlets have woods, you know, to give them shade. And I just happened to be in one corner of the hamlet. And so I don't know what kind of hole it was, but I found a hole. I'm lucky there wasn't a big snake in there, or that I didn't find one anyway. Anyway, they found me after a few minutes, and they were upset, of course, and they wouldn't let me take time to take my flight gear off. They cut it off, and they were, of course, agitated, I guess, which I guess is understandable. But I was kind of surprised, and I think I was a little bit of shock at this time, too, because of all that just happened. But I was, once they got my flight gear off, and they took my boots off there, and then they started marching me into the hamlet, and then they took me into and I guess the thing that was kind of surprising, while they were marching me along, the kids and the old women were very upset with me. They were throwing stones and trying to get at me with sticks. The young women, who were basically in charge, they are the ones that had the guns. They were the militia, because I guess all the young men were away. They were very professional. They kept the kids away and admonished them to quit throwing rocks. But I'd pass old men, and they were actually respectful. They actually, you know, gave a traditional Vietnamese greeting, which is a bow. They actually bow, and I just found that to be kind of amazing. You know, these different mindsets among all these different groups. Anyway, they took me into a little hut or house, and there they took my flight suit off and searched it, but they never did, you know, take off my underwear. I could have had anything I wanted under my underwear if I'd had that foresight, but I was carrying a .38, and they got that, and they got my, and the big other big mistake I made was not tearing up, you know, breaking my radio. So I never did do that, which we were supposed to, so they couldn't use them.
I see.
But anyway, they searched my flight gear. They offered me some water, which I accepted, and I couldn't drink. It was so horrible. It's horrible tasting. So then I flipped my flight suit back on, without my shoes. They kept my flight boots, and then we walked to a bigger village, which was maybe a quarter mile or half mile away, and there they put me in a little bigger house. Very, very poor people there. The house had basically no furnishings. It had a rattan bed. You know, rattan is a bark off of some tree. And the bed was made out of rattan. They had one or two benches, no dirt floor. They had a picture of who I later learned to be Ho Chi Minh on the wall. And they had a one of these big water pipes, you know. That so, but anyway, this was 11 o'clock in the morning, basically, and I stayed there until dusk, basically, because again, they don't travel. They didn't dare take cars out in the daytime there. And while I was there, they blindfolded me, and I just sat there blindfolded inside the house, and all the villagers came by, and some shouted at me and cursed at me, I guess. I don't know what they're saying. And I actually had two groups of Russians came by, and they were, had, I assume, been manning this one of local SAM sites. And one of them could speak a little bit of English, and I asked him, he was told me he was from Georgia, USSR, and I asked him what they were going to do with me, and he said tonight I would go to Hanoi. That was, and then they admonished him for talking to me. So anyway, that was it was kind of interesting afternoon from a culture aspect, you know, just seeing. And I couldn't see much. I could just see a little bit out from underneath my blindfold, but I could see the people that come by and look in the windows, and they were very excited, of course. But well, I don't know, of course, but they were all excited about capturing me. And then about I don't know, dusk, I heard a car, and apparently it come from somewhere else, and then someone came in and got me and took me out in this Russian-made car and put me into it and put me in the back seat. There's two guys in the front and one guy in the back. And of course, I was also tied up. I had my hands tied behind me and my arms tied. Well, basically, my hands tied behind me and blindfolded. And we headed off down the road somewhere. And then they took me to a little larger village where they actually tried, they took me to what looked like a little schoolhouse because there was a blackboard and chalk on the wall. And they tried to interrogate me there, but which I refused to answer anything except my